Chapter 7. Trump heads for the door in Syria and Afghanistan and can't find it. War by radical Islamist terrorists against the United States began long before 9/11 and will continue long after. You can like it or not, but it is reality. Donald Trump didn't like it and acted like it wasn't true. He opposed endless wars in the Middle East, but had no coherent plan for what followed, withdrawing U.S. forces and effectively abandoning key regional allies as the withdrawal unfolded. Trump liked to say, wrongly, it was all thousands of miles away. By contrast, during my time at the White House, I tried to operate in reality, with mixed success. Syria. Lawrence of Arabia, call your office. After our April retaliation for Assad's chemical weapons attack on Douma, Syria re-emerged indirectly through Turkey's incarceration of Pastor Andrew Brunson. An apolitical evangelical preacher, he and his family had lived and worked in Turkey for 2 decades before his arrest in 2016 after a failed military coup against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Brunson was a bargaining chip, cynically charged as conspiring with followers of Fethullah Gulen, an Islamic teacher living in America, once an Erdogan ally, but now an enemy obsessively denounced as a terrorist. Just after Trump's return from Helsinki, Erdogan called to follow up on their brief encounter at NATO, and later phone call, about Brunson and his relationship to Gulen. Erdogan also raised another favorite subject, frequently discussed with Trump, the conviction of Mehmet Atilla, a senior official of the state-run Turkish bank Halkbank, for financial fraud stemming from massive violations of our Iran sanctions. This ongoing criminal investigation threatened Erdogan himself because of allegations he and his family used Halkbank for personal purposes, facilitated further when his son-in-law became Turkey's finance minister. To Erdogan, Gulen and his movement were responsible for the Halkbank charges, so it was all part of a conspiracy against him, not to mention against his family's growing wealth. He wanted the Halkbank case dropped, unlikely now that U.S. prosecutors had their hooks sunk deep into the bank's fraudulent operations. Finally, Erdogan fretted about pending legislation in Congress that would halt the sale of F-35s to Turkey because Ankara was purchasing Russia's S-400 air defense system. If consummated, that purchase would also trigger mandatory sanctions against Turkey under a 2017 anti-Russia sanctions statute. Erdogan had a lot to worry about. What Trump wanted, however, was very limited. When would Brunson be released to return to America, which he thought Erdogan had pledged? Erdogan said only that the Turkish judicial process was continuing, and Brunson was no longer imprisoned, but under house arrest in Izmir, Turkey. Trump replied that he thought that was very unhelpful, because he had expected to hear Erdogan tell him that Brunson, who was just a local minister, was coming home. Trump stressed his friendship with Erdogan, but implied it would be impossible even for him to fix the hard issues facing the U.S.-Turkey relationship unless Brunson returned to the U.S. Trump was genuinely agitated. After a riff on Tillerson and puzzled expressions about Gulen, which Trump claimed was the first time he had heard about it, he said incredulously and inaccurately that Erdogan was telling him that Brunson wouldn't be coming home. That was why no one would do business with Erdogan, Trump complained, especially because America's entire Christian community was upset about this one pastor. They were going crazy. Erdogan answered that the Muslim community in Turkey was going crazy, but Trump interrupted to say they were going crazy all over the world, which they were free to do. If possible, the conversation went downhill thereafter. Trump had finally found someone he relished sanctioning, saying, large sanctions would ensue if Brunson wasn't returned to the U.S. On August 2nd, Treasury sanctioned Turkey's justice and interior ministers, and 2 days later, Turkey sanctioned their counterparts, Sessions and Nielsen, in response. Although he had discussed these measures with Trump, he told me later that day he thought it was insulting to Turkey to sanction cabinet officials. Instead, he wanted to double the existing steel tariffs on Turkey to 50%, which appalled the economic team. Trump had imposed worldwide steel and aluminum tariffs on national security grounds in March 2018 under the authority of Section 232 of the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, a little-known statute that found great favor in Trump trade policy. The national security grounds were gauzy at best. The 232 tariffs were classically protectionist. To use them now for political leverage to obtain Brunson's release violated any known statutory rationale, however worthy the cause. Trump, of course, sensed no one was going to challenge him in these circumstances. Away we went. The Turks, worried about escalating problems with America, wanted a way out, or so we thought, trying to wrap an exchange for Brunson into the Halkbank criminal investigation. This was at best unseemly, but Trump wanted Brunson out, so Pompeo and Mnuchin negotiated with their counterparts. Mnuchin, because Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control was also looking into Halkbank. In three-way conversations, Mnuchin, Pompeo, and I agreed nothing would be done without full agreement from the Justice Department prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, where the case, involving over $20 billion in Iran sanctions violations, was pending. In my days at the Justice Department, we called the Southern District the Sovereign District of New York because it so often resisted control by Maine Justice, let alone by the White House. Several times, Mnuchin was exuberant he had reached a deal with Turkey's finance minister. This was typical. Whether Mnuchin was negotiating with Turkish fraudsters or Chinese trade mandarins, a deal was always in sight. In each case, the deal fell apart when justice tanked it, which was why trying this route to get Brunson's release was never going to work. Pompeo said, "The Turks just can't get out of their own way." But it was in fact justice prosecutors who rightly rejected deals worth next to nothing from the U.S. government's perspective. In the meantime, Turkey's currency continued to depreciate rapidly, and its stock market wasn't doing much better. We had a problem with multiple negotiators on both sides. Haley was conducting conversations with Turkey's UN ambassador, which the Turks said they didn't understand. Neither did we. Pompeo said grimly he would resolve this problem by telling Haley to stop making unauthorized contacts with the Turks, confusing further what was already confused enough. Fortunately, this time it worked. Diplomatic efforts, however, produced nothing on Brunson. Trump allowed the negotiations to continue, but his instinct on Erdogan proved correct. Only economic and political pressure would get Brunson released. And here, at least Trump had no problem applying it despite Mnuchin's happy talk. Erdogan went almost instantly from being one of Trump's best international buddies to being a target of vehement hostility. It kept my hopes alive that Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un, or others would, in due course, inevitably show Trump their true colors, and we could, at that moment, reconnect our errant policies to reality. Also possible, of course, was Trump's returning again to best buddy mode, which did in fact happen here just a few months later. Ironically, although the media painted Trump as viscerally anti-Muslim, he never grasped, despite repeated efforts by key allied leaders in Europe and the Middle East and his own advisors to explain it, that Erdogan was himself a radical Islamicist. He was busy transforming Turkey from Kemal Atatürk's secular state into an Islamist state. He supported the Muslim Brotherhood and other radicals across the Middle East, financing both Hamas and Hezbollah, not to mention being intensely hostile toward Israel, and he helped Iran to evade U.S. sanctions. It never seemed to get through. In the meantime, Trump tired of Turkish delays and obfuscation. And on August 10th, dubious legal authority notwithstanding, he ordered Turkey's steel tariffs doubled to 50% and the aluminum tariffs doubled to 20%, probably the first time in history tariffs were raised by tweet. I have just authorized a doubling of tariffs on steel and aluminum with respect to Turkey, as their currency, the Turkish lira, slides rapidly downward against our very strong dollar. Aluminum will now be 20% and steel 50%. Our relations with Turkey are not good at this time. Turkey retaliated with its own tariffs, and Trump responded by requesting more sanctions. Mnuchin tried to slow-roll Trump on sanctions, which I thought would only frustrate him further. Then the vice president suggested Jared Kushner call Turkey's finance minister, since they were both sons-in-law of their respective countries' leaders. Really, what could go wrong? I briefed Pompeo and Mnuchin on this new son-in-law channel, and they both exploded. Mnuchin because the Turkish son-in-law was finance minister, his counterpart, and Pompeo because this was one more example of Kushner's doing international negotiations he shouldn't have been doing, along with the never-quite-ready Middle East peace plan. I always enjoyed bringing good news. Trump and Kushner were flying to a political fundraiser in the Hamptons where Mnuchin had already arrived, and Kushner called me later to say Mnuchin had calmed down. Kushner also said he had told the Turkish son-in-law he was calling in his personal capacity as a matter of friendship and in no way was signaling weakness to the Turks. I doubted the Turks believed any of that. On August 20th, Trump called me in Israel about a shooting that morning near the U.S. Embassy in Ankara. I had already checked the incident out, finding it to be a local criminal matter unrelated to the U.S. Nonetheless, Trump wondered if we should close the embassy, thereby increasing the heat regarding Brunson, and perhaps do something else, like canceling Turkey's F-35 contract. I called Pompeo and others to fill them in, and asked the NSC staff traveling with me to consider what options might be available. Pompeo thought we should declare Turkey's ambassador persona non grata and directed state's lawyers to contact the White House counsel to confer further. These steps were unorthodox, but we had spent considerable effort on Brunson and still not secured his release. In a few days, however, Trump reversed course, deciding against doing anything on our embassy or Turkey's ambassador, instead returning to the idea of more sanctions. "You have it on Turkey," he said to me, meaning, basically, figure out what to do. He reaffirmed this view a few days later, saying, "Hit 'em. Finish 'em. You got it." And he told Merkel in a phone call that Erdogan was being very obtuse on the Brunson issue, saying, "We would be imposing substantial sanctions in the next few days." The Qataris, who were extending Turkey a massive financial lifeline, also volunteered to help on Brunson, but it was hard to see their effort having any success. In fact, there was very little progress diplomatically, even as the effects of sanctions and the obvious split with the United States over Brunson and other issues, such as buying Russia's S-400 air defense system, continued to wreak havoc across Turkey's economy. Turkey, urgently needing more foreign direct investment, was rapidly moving in the opposite direction, which eventually affected its decision-making. Its judicial system ground its way to yet another hearing on Friday, October 12th, in Izmir, where Brunson had been under house arrest since July. With strong indications the court was working toward releasing him, the Defense Department prepared to stage a plane in Germany in case it was needed to retrieve Brunson and his family. Bizarrely, the court convicted Brunson of espionage and related crimes, which was ridiculous, sentenced him to 5 years in jail, and then decided because of time served and other mitigating factors, he was free to go. This outcome showed that the political fix was in. Erdogan's claim Brunson was a spy had been vindicated for his domestic political purposes, but Brunson went free. At 9:35 a.m., I called Trump, who was, as usual, still in the residence, and said we were 95% certain Brunson was out. Trump was ecstatic, immediately tweeting away, mixed in with a tweet about why Ivanka would be a great UN ambassador. He wanted Brunson brought immediately to the White House, not stopping at the U.S. medical facility at Landstuhl, Germany, for medical observation and care if necessary. Delays in getting the Pentagon plane to Izmir meant Brunson had to overnight in Germany anyway. In turn, that meant his visit to the White House would be Saturday afternoon, when North Carolina members of Congress, his home state, and additional family and friends would attend. After seeing the White House physician just to ensure they were ready for the wild scene about to unfold, Brunson and his wife walked to the West Wing. I spoke to them briefly, surprised to hear that Brunson had followed me for a long time and almost always agreed with me. The Brunsons went to the residence to meet Trump and then walked with him along the colonnade to the Oval Office, where those assembled greeted them with cheers. The press mob entered as the pastor and the president talked. At the end, Brunson knelt next to Trump's chair, put his arm on Trump's shoulder, and prayed for him, which, needless to say, was the photo du jour. So the Brunson matter ended, but bilateral relations with Turkey were at their lowest ebb ever. Before his release, however, conditions in Syria were already deteriorating. We worried in September that Assad was planning to savage Idlib governorate, long an opposition stronghold in northwestern Syria. It was now home to hundreds of thousands of internally displaced Syrians mixed with radical terrorists, as well as a Turkish military presence intended to deter any Assad attack. Russia and Iran would almost certainly assist Assad, producing bloodshed and chaos, and launching massive refugee flows from Syria into Turkey. Along with legitimate refugees, thousands of terrorists would escape, many of whom would head to Europe, their preferred destination. I was particularly worried Assad might again use chemical weapons, and I pushed urgently for the Defense Department to think about a possible military response, hopefully again with Britain and France, in case it happened. I didn't want to be unprepared as in April. If required, retaliation should not again just aim at degrading Syria's chemical weapons capability, but at permanently altering Assad's proclivity to use it. This time, Mattis freed the Joint Chiefs to do what they should do. There was extensive advance planning based on alternative assumptions, limitations, for example, rigorously avoiding the risk of civilian casualties, and objectives. Unlike in April, I felt that if worse came to worst, we were ready to present real options for Trump to choose from. In the meantime, Israel wasn't waiting around, repeatedly striking Iranian shipments of weapons and supplies that could be threatening. Jerusalem had its own communications with Moscow, because Netanyahu was not after Russian targets or personnel, only Iranians and terrorists. Russia's real problem was its Syrian allies, who shot down a Russian surveillance plane in mid-September, which also prompted Moscow to turn over elements of its S-300 air defense system to the Syrians, troubling Israel greatly. In Iraq on Saturday, September 8th, Shia militia groups, undoubtedly supplied by Iran, attacked Embassy Baghdad and our Basra consulate, and Iran launched missiles against targets near Erbil in Kurdish Iraq. Coming days before the anniversary of 9/11 and with the 2012 assault on our Benghazi diplomatic compound on our minds, we needed to think strategically about our response. We did not. Kelly told me that, after a campaign event, Trump unleashed to him yet again on wanting out of the Middle East entirely. Dead Americans in Iraq, tragic in themselves, might accelerate withdrawal, to our long-term detriment and that of our Israel and our Arab allies, if we didn't think this through carefully. By Monday, however, our response was down to a possible statement condemning Iran's role in the attacks. Mattis opposed even that, still arguing we weren't absolutely sure the Shia militia groups were tied to Iran, which defied credulity. Our indecision continued until Tuesday, when Mattis precipitated an Oval Office meeting on this one-paragraph statement with Trump, Pence, Mattis, Pompeo, Kelly, and me. It was now so late, few would notice it, whatever it said. This was Mattis obstructionism at work. No kinetic response, and perhaps not even a press release responding to attacks on U.S. diplomatic personnel and facilities. What lesson did Iran and the militias draw from our complete passivity? Predictably, there were renewed threats by Shia militia groups within weeks, and two more rocket attacks on the Basra consulate. Pompeo decided almost immediately to close the consulate, which employed over 1,000 people, including government employees and contractors, to avoid a Benghazi-like catastrophe. This time, even Mattis could not deny the Iran connection. Betraying no sense of irony, however, and still opposing any kinetic action in response, he worried that shuttering the consulate would signal we were retreating from Iraq. Nonetheless, on September 28th, Pompeo announced the consulate's closure. When we come to the events of summer 2019 and the shooting down of U.S. drones and other belligerent Iranian acts in the region, remember well these administration failures to respond to the provocations 1 year earlier. Shortly thereafter, Trump flipped again on Erdogan and Turkey. With the Brunson matter now 6 weeks behind us, the two leaders met bilaterally on December 1st at the Buenos Aires G20 summit, largely discussing Halkbank. Erdogan provided a memo by the law firm representing Halkbank, which Trump did nothing more than flip through before declaring he believed Halkbank was totally innocent of violating U.S.-Iran sanctions. Trump asked whether we could reach acting U.S. Attorney General Matt Whitaker, which I sidestepped. Trump then told Erdogan he would take care of things, explaining that the Southern District prosecutors were not his people, but were Obama people, a problem that would be fixed when they were replaced by his people. Of course, this was all nonsense, since the prosecutors were career Justice Department employees who would have proceeded the same way if the Halkbank investigation started in the 8th year of Trump's presidency rather than the 8th year of Obama's. It was as though Trump was trying to show he had as much arbitrary authority as Erdogan, who had said 20 years earlier as mayor of Istanbul, "Democracy is like a streetcar. You ride it to the stop you want, and then you get off." Trump rolled on, claiming he didn't want anything bad to happen to Erdogan or Turkey, and that he would work very hard on the issue. Erdogan also complained about Kurdish forces in Syria, which Trump didn't address, and then raised Fethullah Gulen, asking yet again that he be extradited to Turkey. Trump hypothesized that Gulen would last for only 1 day if he were returned to Turkey. The Turks laughed, but said Gulen needn't worry, since Turkey had no death penalty. Fortunately, the bilateral ended shortly thereafter. Nothing good was going to come of this renewed bromance with yet another authoritarian foreign leader. In fact, the Europeans had already shifted attention from the risks of an Assad assault into Idlib governorate to concern about a Turkish attack in northeastern Syria, the triangular region east of the Euphrates River, south of Turkey, and west of Iraq. Largely under Syrian opposition control and dominated by Kurdish fighters, several thousand U.S. and allied troops were deployed there to assist the continuing offensive against ISIS's territorial caliphate. Begun under Obama, whose misguided policies in Iraq contributed heavily to the emergence of ISIS and its caliphate to begin with, the offensive was finally nearing success. It was close to eliminating ISIS's territorial holdings in western Iraq and eastern Syria, although not eliminating ISIS itself, which still held the allegiance of thousands of fighters and terrorists living in and roaming through Iraq and Syria, but not controlling any defined territory. Erdogan was purportedly interested in destroying the caliphate, but his real enemy was the Kurds, who, he believed with some justification, were allied to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in Turkey, which the U.S. had long considered a terrorist group. Why we were affiliated with one terrorist group in order to destroy another stemmed from Obama's failure to see that Iran was a much more serious threat, now and in the future. Many parties to this conflict opposed ISIS, including Iran, its terrorist proxy Hezbollah, and its near satellite Syria. Tehran, however, unlike Obama, was also focusing on the next war, the one after ISIS was defeated. As the ISIS caliphate shrank, Iran was expanding its span of control in the region, leaving the U.S. with its awkward squad of allies. That said, America had long supported Kurdish efforts for greater autonomy or even independence from Iraq, and a Kurdish state would require border adjustments for existing states in the neighborhood. It was complicated, but what was not complicated was the strong U.S. sense of loyalty to Kurds who had fought with us against ISIS, and fear that abandoning them was not only disloyal, but would have severely adverse consequences worldwide for any future effort to recruit allies who might later be seen as expendable. In the meantime, there was turmoil at the Pentagon. On Friday, December 7th, at our weekly breakfast, Mattis said somberly to Pompeo and me, "You gentlemen have more political capital than I do now," which sounded ominous. Mark Milley's nomination to succeed Dunford as chairman of the Joint Chiefs would be announced the next day, before the Army-Navy game, but we knew it was coming. Milley, then Army Chief of Staff, had impressed Trump and won the job on his own. Mattis had tried to force his preferred candidate on Trump, but many Trump supporters believed that the last thing he needed was a Mattis clone as chairman. By pushing prematurely, perhaps because Mattis knew he would be leaving well before Dunford's term expired on September 30, 2019, Mattis had hurt his own cause. At our next wardroom breakfast, Thursday, December 13th, the mood was decidedly unhappy for several reasons, but largely because we all felt, silently to be sure, Mattis was coming to the end of his ride. It didn't bother me that Mattis's obstructionism would be leaving with him, but his departure was part of a problematic, almost inevitable pattern. None of the three prior Republican administrations in which I served had seen anything approaching this extent and manner of senior-level turnover. On December 14th, Trump and Erdogan spoke by phone. I briefed Trump beforehand on the situation in Syria, and he said, "We should get the hell out of there," which I feared he would also say directly to Erdogan. Trump started by saying we were getting very close to a resolution on Halkbank. He had just spoken to Mnuchin and Pompeo and said we would be dealing with Erdogan's great son-in-law, Turkey's finance minister, to get it off his shoulders. Erdogan was very grateful, speaking in English, no less. Then he switched to Syria. He said Trump knew Turkey's expectations regarding the YPG, a Syrian Kurdish militia, part of the opposition Syrian Defense Forces, and the FETÖ, Gulenist terrorist network, which Erdogan characterized as threats to Turkish national security, which were poisoning bilateral relations between Washington and Ankara. Nonetheless, whined Erdogan, contrary to fact, America was continuing to train YPG forces, including up to 30 to 40,000 new recruits. He complained of the discrepancy between Trump's political will and U.S. military activities on the ground, which were causing questions in his mind. Turkey, said Erdogan, wanted to get rid of ISIS and the PKK, although, in my view, by PKK, he was really referring to Kurdish fighters generally. Trump said he was ready to leave Syria if Turkey wanted to handle the rest of ISIS. Turkey could do the rest, and we would just get out. Erdogan promised his word on that point, but said his forces needed logistical support. Then came the painful part. Trump said he would ask me, I was listening into the call as was customary, to immediately work on a plan for U.S. withdrawal, with Turkey taking over the fight against ISIS. He said I should work it out quietly, but that we were leaving because ISIS is finished. Trump asked if I could speak, which I did, saying I had heard his instructions. As the call came to an end after further discussion on Halkbank, Trump said Erdogan should work with me on the military, telling me to do a good job, and Mnuchin on Halkbank. Erdogan thanked Trump and called him a very practical leader. Shortly thereafter, Trump said we should craft a statement that we had won the fight against ISIS, we had completed our mission in Syria, and we were now getting out. There was little doubt in my mind that Trump had seized on withdrawing from Syria as another campaign promise, like Afghanistan, he was determined to say he had kept. I called Mattis shortly thereafter to brief him. Needless to say, he was not thrilled. This was a personal crisis for me. I felt that withdrawing from Syria was a huge mistake, because of both the continuing global threat of ISIS and the fact that Iran's substantial influence would undoubtedly grow. I had argued to Pompeo and Mattis as far back as June that we should end our piecemeal policy in Syria, looking at one province or area at a time, for example, Manbij, Idlib, the Southwest Exclusion Zone, etc., and focus on the big picture. With most of the ISIS territorial caliphate gone, although the ISIS threat itself was far from eliminated, the big picture was stopping Iran. Now, however, if the U.S. abandoned the Kurds, they would either have to ally with Assad against Turkey, which the Kurds rightly considered the greater threat, thereby enhancing Assad, Iran's proxy, or fight on alone, facing almost certain defeat, caught in the vice between Assad and Erdogan. What to do? First, on December 18th, Mattis, Dunford, Coates, Haspel, Pompeo, and I, and a few others, convened in the tank in the Pentagon rather than the sit room to attract less attention. Based on the Trump-Erdogan call, the Turks were doubtless telling anyone who would listen that we were turning northeastern Syria over to their tender mercies. The potential dangers on the ground were daunting, starting with the thousands of ISIS prisoners held by the Kurds, pending some decision on their disposition. Estimates of the actual numbers of prisoners varied, in part due to differing definitions. Were they foreign terrorist fighters, meaning from outside the Middle East? From outside Syria and Iraq? Or local? Whatever the number, we did not want them moving en masse to the United States or Europe. In mid-December, Trump suggested bringing the ISIS prisoners in northeastern Syria to Gitmo, but Mattis objected. Trump then insisted that other countries take back their own nationals from the Kurdish camps, which was hardly unreasonable, but which foreign governments strongly resisted, not wanting the terrorists coming home. No one did, but this resistance hardly contributed to a solution. As events developed, we did not resolve the issue before I left the White House. Finally, exactly how long would it take for the U.S. and other coalition forces to leave in a safe and orderly fashion? Dunford's planners estimated about 120 days. It certainly wasn't a matter of 48 hours. I asked about holding on to the At-Tanf exclusion zone, located inside Syria at the tri-border junction of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, not in northeastern Syria, but which U.S. forces held. Control at At-Tanf neutralized a key border crossing point on the road between Baghdad and Damascus, which forced Iran and others to cross from Iraq into Syria at a more distant border crossing to the north. Surprisingly, Mattis was skeptical of At-Tanf's worth, probably because he was focused on ISIS rather than Iran. Iran was my main concern, and I stayed firm on At-Tanf throughout my time as National Security Advisor. Besides, why give territory away for nothing? As we had agreed, Mattis, Dunford, Pompeo, and I began to call our allies to prepare them for what was about to happen, receiving no sign of support. Francis Etienne told me Macron would certainly want to talk to Trump about the decision, which didn't surprise me. Other reactions were equally predictable. I was in the Oval that afternoon when Macron's call came through, and he was not happy. Trump brushed him aside, saying we were finished with ISIS and that Turkey and Syria would take care of any remnants. Macron replied that Turkey was focused on attacking the Kurds and would compromise with ISIS. He pleaded with Trump not to withdraw, saying that we would win in a very short time and should finish the job. Trump agreed to consult again with his advisors, telling me I should talk with Macron's people, which I had already done, and Mattis and Dunford that they should talk to their counterparts. Almost immediately, Mattis called to say that French Defense Minister Florence Parly was not at all happy with Trump's decision. Israel's Ambassador Ron Dermer told me that this was the worst day he had experienced thus far in the Trump administration. The next day, Wednesday, December 19th, Mattis, Pompeo, and I had our weekly breakfast in the wardroom, dominated by Syria, notwithstanding our extensive Pentagon discussion the day before. Numerous press stories had appeared filled with inaccuracies, which I thought came largely from the Pentagon via allies in Congress. Later in the day, Trump tweeted a video with his own explanation, and press and congressional calls were overwhelming the White House, which, other than the NSC, was yet again focused on the Mexico border wall and related immigration topics. Republicans in Congress almost uniformly opposed Trump's Syria decision, but largely said they would avoid the media, an inhibition Democrats did not share. Republican acquiescence in mistaken national security policies, however, didn't help the country or ultimately the party. I reported on the negative Hill reaction that morning, but Trump didn't believe it, probably relying again on Rand Paul's assurances that he represented the party's real base. As if this weren't enough, Turkey detained a Texas National Guardsman on duty at Incirlik Air Base near Adana, which problem, unlike Brunson's, was resolved quickly. By Thursday, Trump understood he was getting mauled by media coverage of the Syria withdrawal, which was a small fraction of what would happen if he proceeded to leave Afghanistan completely. We concluded it was not wise to set a deadline for withdrawal, but stressed it should be orderly. The Turkish military provided a potential lifeline in that regard. They knew full well there had to be military-to-military talks on an orderly transfer of power in an otherwise essentially ungoverned region before the handover Trump proposed could succeed. Those talks would take time, and indeed, the U.S. delegation was making plans to travel to Ankara only on Monday, Christmas Eve, the next week. That afternoon, I learned that Mattis was in the Oval alone with Trump, and a previously scheduled bill-signing ceremony was running very late. As we were talking, Mattis came out, with Trump right behind him. I could tell instantly something was up. Mattis seemed stunned to see me waiting, but he shook hands without much of an expression. Trump said, "John, come on in," which I did, with just the two of us in the Oval. "He's leaving," said Trump. I never really liked him. After the bill-signing ceremony, Trump and I talked for roughly 20 minutes on how to handle the Mattis departure. Trump wanted to put out a tweet before Mattis's public relations machine got rolling. Mattis had given Trump a long resignation letter explaining why he was leaving, unquestionably written for widespread public distribution, which Trump had not actually read. Instead, he had simply left it on the Resolute desk, from which it had been removed for the bill-signing ceremony. When we retrieved the letter, I read with surprise that Mattis wanted to serve until the end of February, spending his remaining time as Secretary of Defense, testifying before Congress and speaking at the February NATO Defense Ministers meeting. Even more surprising to Trump, given the tenor of his conversation with Mattis, was the letter's substance, rejecting Trump's policies. I explained to Trump that the scheduling was completely untenable, though I was not sure it sank in. He was, however, more and more expressive about how much he didn't like Mattis. "I created a monster when I named him Mad Dog," said Trump, which was at least partially correct. Mattis's real moniker was Chaos. I returned to my office to call Pompeo at 5:20 p.m., and by then, Trump's tweet was out and the Mattis press blitz underway. Pompeo said Mattis had stopped by state on the way to the White House, giving him a copy of the resignation letter. Mattis said, "The president doesn't pay attention to me anymore. It's his way of saying he doesn't want me. It's time to leave." I thought all these things were true, and Pompeo agreed. All this turmoil over Mattis, of course, affected the Syrian and parallel Afghan dramas, especially because Mattis made Trump's order for U.S. forces to exit Syria the determining factor in his resignation. Nonetheless, the succession question remained. By Saturday, 2 days after the Mattis meeting in the Oval, Trump told me at about 6:15 p.m. that he wasn't waiting around for February for Mattis's departure and had decided to name Deputy Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan as Acting Secretary of Defense. At this point, Trump was torn between nominating Shanahan for the job full-time and naming retired General Jack Keane. In addition, Trump now wanted Mattis out immediately, not even coming to the Pentagon on Monday. I pointed out it was almost Christmas, and Trump said, "Christmas isn't until Tuesday. We should fire him today." On Sunday, December 23rd, I spoke with Trump just before a 10 a.m. call with Erdogan. Trump had just finished a good talk with Shanahan, whom he had found very impressive. Trump wondered why he had not been so impressed in their previous encounters. He supplied his own answer, with which I agreed, that Shanahan had been held down over there at the Pentagon by Mattis, adding, "He loves you and Pompeo." A January 1st start date, however, would still leave Mattis in place until December 31st, and Trump was rumbling again that he wanted him out immediately. I said I would see what could be done, and then immediately called Shanahan, who was in Seattle with his family. I suggested that, Christmas or no Christmas, he should think about returning to Washington immediately. I also called Dunford, reaching him as he landed at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. I told him what had happened with Erdogan on Syria and with Mattis, which he appreciated because no one else had conveyed the Pentagon news. I assured Dunford that Trump wanted him to stay as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, which I sort of made up, but which I expected was true and appropriate to ease any concerns with the turmoil Mattis had caused. At least for now, we seemed to be steady again. But Syria was still in flux. Over the weekend, Trump decided he wanted another call with Erdogan to make 2 points. First, don't attack any U.S. troops in Syria, and second, be sure to attack ISIS and not Kurds. Both points being correct, but it was a little late to fill them in after his earlier call with Erdogan and the subsequent publicity. So, after greetings and opening remarks, Trump said that first, he wanted Erdogan to get rid of ISIS, and that we would provide assistance if Turkey needed. Second, he pressed Erdogan not to go after the Kurds and kill them, noting that a lot of people liked them for fighting with us for years against ISIS. Turkey and the Kurds should go after the remaining ISIS forces together. Trump acknowledged that such a strategy might be a change for Erdogan, but he stressed again how much support there was for the Kurds in the United States. Trump then came with what he thought was the clincher, the prospect of substantially greater U.S. trade with Turkey. Erdogan took pains to say he loved the Kurds and vice versa, but added that the YPG-PYD-PKK, three Kurdish groups in Turkey and Syria, the 9 initials of which Erdogan rattled off as if spelling his own name, were manipulating the Kurds and did not represent them. He pointed out that his government had Kurdish MPs and ministers, that the Kurds had a special love and sympathy for him, and that he was the only leader who could conduct big rallies in the Kurdish areas. He had no intention of killing anyone but terrorists. We had heard all this before, and it was standard Erdogan regime propaganda. Rallies! What an appeal to Trump! At this point, perhaps recognizing he was being drawn into a trap on the Kurds, those Erdogan planned to decimate versus those who loved coming to hear him, a distinction we had no business trying to help Erdogan with, Trump asked me to say what I thought of Erdogan's comments. On the spur of the moment, I said we should leave it to the upcoming military-to-military discussions to distinguish the terrorists from the non-terrorists. My feeling was that parsing this question would go absolutely nowhere, thereby postponing our departure from Syria. Christmas Eve and Christmas Day were quiet. At 9:45 p.m. Christmas night, my Secret Service detail and I left for Andrews, where, under extraordinary security precautions, Trump, the First Lady, and a small traveling party boarded Air Force One to head for Iraq, 8 hours ahead of Washington time. I got some sleep and woke up in time to see that word of the trip still hadn't broken, and that security was good enough that we could continue to our destination at Al-Assad Air Base, where we expected, among other things, to meet with Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi and several top officials. Trump also arose early, although it was already afternoon Iraq time, and we spent a fair amount of time in his office chatting away because so few others were up yet. We ranged from what he would say to the Army and Marine troops at Al-Assad and in the State of the Union address in January to sending a New Year's greeting to Xi Jinping and whether Trump should get the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump also raised the widespread political rumor he would dump Pence from the ticket in 2020 and run instead with Haley, asking what I thought. White House gossip was common that Ivanka and Kushner favored this approach, which tied in with Haley's leaving her position as UN ambassador in December 2018, thus allowing her to do some politicking around the country before being named to the ticket in 2020. The political argument in Haley's favor was that she could win back women voters alienated from Trump. By contrast, it was said, the evangelicals supporting Pence had nowhere else to go in 2020, so their votes were not at risk if Haley took his place. I explained it was a bad idea to jettison someone loyal, and that doing so risked alienating people he needed, who could stay home, even if they didn't vote for Trump's opponent, without necessarily generating new support because of the replacement. That seemed to be Trump's thinking as well. We landed at Al-Assad about 7:15 p.m. local time in near total darkness and under the tightest security possible. We careened away from Air Force One in heavily armored Humvees, heading for the tent where the U.S. commanders would meet us. As we drove along, it became clear we were not really certain whether Abdul Mahdi was actually coming or not. For security reasons, he had received minimal notice. But we heard a plane was on the way from Baghdad, the only uncertainty being whether Abdul Mahdi was on it. Greeting the President and the First Lady in the tent, arranged with tables, chairs, and flags, were Army Lieutenant General Paul LaCamera, the commander of Operation Inherent Resolve in Iraq and Syria, Air Force Brigadier General Dan Kane, nicknamed Raising, the Deputy Commander, and several others. I wanted a little more inherent resolve in the administration, so I took LaCamera aside and urged him to stress the threat from Iran in Syria, in addition to whatever else he planned to say. If I had to pick one clear point in time that saved the U.S. military presence in Syria, at least through the end of my White House tenure, this was it. Sitting in this tent, at the makeshift conference table, with the President and First Lady at the head and the rest of us on the sides, after the obligatory performance before the traveling press pool. The press left about 8 p.m. and LaCamera and his colleagues began what I'm sure they thought would be a standard briefing, where they talked and the President listened. Were they in for a surprise? LaCamera got only as far as, "It's crystal clear that we are to get out of Syria," when Trump interrupted with questions and comments. LaCamera said at one point, "I can protect our interests in Syria while withdrawing, and I can do it from here." Trump said he had told Erdogan not to attack U.S. forces in Syria, and LaCamera and Kane were explaining what they were currently doing against ISIS when Trump asked, "Can you knock the shit out of them on the way out?" They both responded, "Yes, sir." And Trump said, "That is my order. Take it out from here." LaCamera proceeded to explain that the U.S. had been seeking to build partnership capacity over the years, but Trump interrupted to say he had given repeated extensions of the time needed to defeat ISIS and was tired of doing so. He then asked, "What can we do to protect the Kurds?" And I jumped in to tell the commanders that the president had expressly told Erdogan that he didn't want harm done to the Kurds who had helped us in Syria. LaCamera and Kane explained they could finish off the ISIS territorial caliphate in the next 2 to 4 weeks. "Do it," said Trump. "You have the okay on that," asking why Mattis and others couldn't have finished the job in the last year and a half. Trump came to believe he was hearing a lot of this information for the first time, which may or may not have been true, but was his view nonetheless. As the discussion moved on, LaCamera said that the al-Assad base was also critical to keep pressure on Iran. Trump asked quizzically, "Staying in Iraq puts more pressure on Iran?" U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Douglas Silliman, answered, "Yes," emphatically. And LaCamera and others agreed. Trump began to bring the meeting to a close by saying he wanted a vicious withdrawal from Syria and that he saw a continuing U.S. presence in Iraq as being a linchpin for a number of reasons. I decided to press my luck, asking LaCamera and Kane about the value of the At-Tanith exclusion zone. LaCamera was saying, "I haven't briefed my bosses yet," when I interrupted, pointed to POTUS, and said, "You are now." LaCamera, to his credit, recovered quickly and said we should hold on to At-Tanif. Trump responded, "Okay, and we'll decide the schedule on that later." Trump and the First Lady shortly thereafter moved off to a mess tent nearby to meet service members, and Stephen Miller, Sarah Sanders, and I stayed back with LaCamera, Kane, and the other commanders to draft a statement we could release publicly. We wrote that the president and the commanders discussed a strong, deliberate, and orderly withdrawal of U.S. and coalition forces from Syria and the continuing importance of the U.S. presence in Iraq to prevent a resurgence of the ISIS territorial threat and to protect other U.S. interests, which all agreed was a fair summary of the meeting. I thought the outcome was fantastic, not because we had a final decision on U.S. military activity in Syria, but because Trump had come away with a very different appreciation for what we were doing and why it was important. How long it would last was a separate question, but I planned to move while the impression was strong. And why had Trump's advisors not gotten him to Iraq or Afghanistan earlier? We had all collectively failed on that score. By the time we finished drafting the statement, it was clear Prime Minister Abdul-Mahdi was not coming, a big mistake on his part. His advisors convinced him it was unseemly for Iraq's prime minister to meet the president on an American base, notwithstanding that our facility was completely surrounded by an Iraqi base, which had once been ours as well. They had a good phone call instead, and Trump invited Abdul-Mahdi to the White House, a positive sign. We rode to a hangar where Trump addressed the troops, receiving an enthusiastic reception. Even Americans callous about our country and indifferent to its greatness would be moved by the enthusiasm, optimism, and strength of spirit of our service members, even in the middle of the Iraqi desert. This really was America's inherent resolve in the flesh. The rally ended at about 10:25 p.m., and we motorcaded in the dark back to Air Force One to fly to Ramstein Air Base in Germany to refuel. I called Pompeo to report on the Iraq visit and then talked to Shanahan and Dunford, who was in Poland, having just left al-Assad the night before. We landed at Ramstein at 1:45 a.m. German time, met with the U.S. commanders there, and then rode to a hangar with a large crowd of service members waiting to greet the commander-in-chief at 2 a.m. Trump shook hands and took selfies with many service members along the rope line the base had fashioned. Then, back to Air Force One, headed for Andrews, where we landed at 5:15 a.m. on December 27th, all of 20 minutes behind the original schedule. Trump called me later in the afternoon to urge moving forward quickly with the 2-week plan, to finish off the ISIS territorial caliphate in Syria. I said I had heard 2 to 4 weeks from La Camera and Kane, which he didn't contest, but he said anyway, call it the 2-week plan. I briefed Dunford in more detail, having found almost immediately after Mattis left that Dunford could handle the confused, often conflicting array of Trump's Syria priorities. Withdraw, crush ISIS, protect the Kurds, decide how to handle at-Tanf, don't release the prisoners, keep the pressure on Iran. These were presidential outbursts, off-the-cuff comments, knee-jerk reactions, not a coherent, straight-line strategy, but bits and pieces we needed to thread our way through to get to a satisfactory outcome. What Dunford and I feared, along with many others, was ISIS's making a comeback in the regions it had formerly controlled, thereby once again threatening to become a base from which to launch terrorist attacks against America and Europe. I also wanted to minimize any potential gains for Iran, something Mattis never seemed to prioritize, but which Dunford understood better. He and I discussed developing a plan to accommodate all these priorities, which was difficult but far superior to the Mattis style, which veered from insisting we had to remain in Syria indefinitely to saying, in effect, he would spite the president by doing exactly what he said, withdraw immediately. Since Erdogan appeared to believe that the only good Kurd is a dead Kurd, big rallies notwithstanding, Dunford thought Turkey's immediate military objective in Syria would be to expel Kurds from the area along the Turkey-Syria border and then move hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees from Turkey back across the border into the now largely depopulated border zone. He suggested creating a NATO-based monitoring force supported by American intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, air cover, and a dial 911 capability to intervene if elements of the monitoring force ran into trouble with minimal U.S. forces on the ground. I was also happy when Dunford quickly agreed on keeping U.S. forces in at-Tanf, which Mattis had not. Perhaps there was a way ahead. Dunford suggested he join the early January trip I was planning to Turkey and then stay afterward to talk to their military, which I agreed to. This way, the Turks would hear a unified U.S. government message, thereby lessening their ability to exploit differences among the various American players, always a favorite foreign government strategy. I briefed Pompeo on these discussions, saying we had prevented a very bad outcome in Syria and were verging now on constructing something adequate and doable. Pompeo wanted to be sure the State Department envoy handling Syria was present for the Turkey meetings, which I agreed to reluctantly. That's because Pompeo himself had told me 2 days before Christmas that Jim Jeffrey, a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, had no love lost for the Kurds and still saw Turkey as a reliable NATO partner. Those were clear warning signs of an advanced case of clientitis, a chronic State Department affliction where the foreign perspective becomes more important than that of the U.S. Pompeo, Shanahan, Dunford, and I agreed to draft a 1-page statement of principles on Syria to avoid misunderstandings, which defense thought was particularly important.